and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Alaska historian Laurel Downing Bill, the woman behind the Aunt Phil's Trunk history books. Bill tells the story of how her own Alaskan family, three generations of them, led her to become a history sleuth. Since she got hooked on history, Bill has authored four books, and there's a fifth one on the way. She tells listeners about the research that goes into each book and what inspires her to keep pursuing the little-known stories from the last frontier. This talk was recorded September 11th at the Lusac Library in Anchorage. It's been edited for broadcast. And without further ado, here's Laurel Downing Bill.
As she said, my name is Laurel Downing Bill. I am a third generation on both sides of my family. On my grandfather, on my father's side, his name was John Cooch Downing. He was the captain of the steamships, the Portland, the Excelsior, and the Bertha, all extensive histories in Alaska. The Portland and the Excelsior were the two ships that started the Klondike Gold Rush by carrying the gold from St. Michael down to Seattle and San Francisco in 1898 timeframe. His son, my grandfather Walter Downing, came to Alaska in 1914 when my Aunt Phyllis, for whom my series is named, was 5 years old. Walter helped build the Copper River Railroad to the Kennecott Copper Mines and stayed on in Cordova for the rest pretty much of his life until he retired down to Oregon. Phyllis was 5 years old at the time. She grew up to become a school teacher. Her first teaching gig was in Cooper Landing. She had 7 students. She was up at 4 in the morning stoking the stove to get the little schoolhouse nice and warm for her kids. 3 of her students were little girls belonging to a widower whose last name was Carlson. Carl Carlson. They fell in love. They got married. He moved her to Tyonek, where he was the postmaster. She was a school teacher. Later in life, after the earthquake, when Tyonek had to relocate, the elders invited Aunt Phyllis back to Tyonek, and they gave her a potlatch and asked her to share stories of the shaman and the chief that she had befriended during the 1930s. So that kind of puts into perspective how much respect was given to Aunt Phyllis. Aunt Phyllis wrote many wonderful stories about Alaska. She was an incredible researcher. She was on the Alaska Historical Society board. She was involved with so many things with Alaska's history. She just loved Alaska's history. She wrote stories for the likes of Seattle Post-Intelligencer, San Francisco Chronicle, the Alaska Sportsman, which became the Alaska Magazine later, and she won national awards for her work. Well, she moved into Anchorage after the earthquake. She was living in Cordova at the time, 1964, and she spent so much time at the Z.J. Lusac Library researching for her stories, they said, "Why don't you just come work for us?" So she did. And one of the stories that I love about Aunt Phyllis that people would tell is that they would go in and she would always know who they were, but she could never remember their names. But she could tell you what she looked up for you. That's how much she loved Alaska's history. So Aunt Phyllis passed away in 1993. I was living in King Salmon for 23 years with my handsome biologist husband sitting over there, Don Bill, who managed the world's largest red salmon fishery for 20 years for fish and game. We retired into Anchorage in 1997, and my sister had been taking care of my aunt, and she had my aunt's body of work. The stepchildren had gone through everything they wanted, brothers, sisters had gone through what they wanted, and my sister had all of my aunt's research, clippings, newspaper articles, her awards, and said, "Laurel, go through all this stuff. If there's something you want, fine. If not, I just can't hang on to all this anymore." Well, my husband had planned for us just to go golfing the rest of our lives. As I'm going through these boxes and I'm coming across these articles and these awards, I am saying to myself, we cannot throw this away. So I told my dear sweet husband that his plans for us just to go golf the rest of our lives was going to be altered just a little bit. I wanted to do the best I could to portray my aunt's work and also share Alaska's history in such a way where people would not want to put the books down, in the same manner that she had written her articles. Well, to do that, I needed tools. My past life, I was the assistant general manager for the Bristol Bay Telephone Cooperative. I logged 2 million miles on Delta Airlines alone, flying to Washington, D.C., talking to senators and congressmen about why they needed to worry about Alaska telephone rates so the little ladies that live in the rural communities could still have phone service and afford it. I had great business letter experience, but not the experience I knew I needed to do what I envisioned to do with Aunt Phil's work. So I went back to college at 50-some years old, scared to death. I did not think I was smart enough to go to school. I don't know, a lot of women in our age group, you're busy raising kids and you really weren't brought up in my era that college was the thing you needed to do. And so I was really, really scared. My kids had gone to college, my husband, my brothers, my sisters, everybody but me. Well, I went and I got a degree in 2003 in journalism with a minor in history. And I started Aunt Phil's Trunk as a newspaper column. Does anyone remember the Anchorage Chronicle? It was a little weekly newspaper. It was awesome. It was from 2002, July, until the end of 2004. Chilista Corporation was the force behind it. It also had the newspapers in Seward and Valdez and all over the state. We had 7 rural newspapers, but this was the weekly one. So I started this as Aunt Phil's Trunk weekly newspaper. Well, it became so popular, I thought maybe people would be interested in learning a little bit more and make my stories a little bit bigger and actually put it into a book. So that's what I started to do. The very first book actually came out May 2006. Aunt Phyllis wrote 60% of the first book. 80% of the first book. I wrote 20. How I went about this project was laying out everything I had, she had written and her research all over my dining room, living room, and kitchen floors. And I did it all in chronological order. And then I saw some holes. Aunt Phyllis had never written about Juno, for instance. Well, I thought the people of Southeast would be a bit miffed if they weren't included in Alaska history. So I did that research, and then I tried to write as my aunt wrote, so readers would not be jarred with a different style of writing in between the chapters. Another way I contributed was I was doing a story on the purchase of Alaska that Aunt Phil had written, page 67. I could only find Secretary of State Seward in profile shot. And being curious of nature, I wondered how come. So I started researching. What I learned was he was almost assassinated the same day Lincoln was murdered. There was a Confederate conspiracy to kill all the top Union officials, throw the Union into chaos. Well, the assassin who was assigned to Seward made it into his home. He raced up his stairs and found Seward laying in bed with a big brace around his neck because he'd had a carriage accident the day before and he was all laid up trying to get healthy. Well, the assassin made it into his home and started stabbing him multiple times in the head. And I found this woodcut engraving from the National Police Gazette, April 14, 1865, that showed what the attack looked like. And then I kept digging. And I found a rare photo of what he looked like after the attack, which answered my question, why I could only find him in profile after a certain age. Because he was maimed in that knife attack and he did not want people to see him. So when I came across other little stories that I could add into her stories that would try to give it a little bit more pizzazz, so to speak, I would weave them into her stories. And I thought, well, you know, in this day and age, images are really important to keep especially younger people's attention. So what I decided to do was go through thousands and thousands of photographs at museums and libraries and universities and find photographs to go with every single story that I put into the book. The result is every book has close to 350 historical photographs to go with the stories. And I hired a professional photographer to clean up the images. So when you, the reader, is looking at them, you know it's not like going through the darkness trying to find where's the moose. So the first one was tons of fun to do. Aunt Phyllis has, like I said, 80% of it, because she was really interested in early Alaska, where the natives first arrived thousands of years ago, crossing the Bering Sea Land Bridge. Which reminds me, I was doing a presentation in Texas earlier this year, and it was a large group of folks. Some of them were Hispanic speakers, Spanish-speaking Americans, coming over from the border of Mexico, making homes in America. And one of those gentlemen, I was talking about how DNA evidence they're finding has tied our Alaska natives, some of them to Navajo and Apache in the lower 48. And he said, really? Well, you know, I think they made it, some of them, all the way into Mexico. And I said, really? Well, where did you come across this? And he said, well, you know, you just all you have to do is cross the border and you go into the shops and pick up some pottery and turn it over and it says made in China. He got me good on that one. So the first one does talk about the early days with the native people arriving, where they settled. It also shares the stories then of the Russians coming, searching for their furs. They knew about the gold. They knew about oil. They discovered all those things while they were out doing their explorations, but they did not want anyone else to know about it because they didn't want anyone else coming into Alaska and disrupting their fur industry. The Americans coming when the purchase, 1867. That's a very interesting story. My aunt did write the story in here on the purchase of Alaska. And I was down at the Saturday market a year after this book came out, and I had a poster up which showed a picture, and I'll get to it in a second here. It is on page 122, that showed the amount represented in a gold cube of the amount of money that America paid Russia for Alaska. And right next to it is a pile of gold of what came out of the Juneau Treadwell mine in just a few years, which really shows you America got a pretty good deal right from the get-go. Well, this gentleman, he's looking at that poster, and then he looks at me, and he goes, that's not true. America didn't pay $7.2 million for Alaska. They paid $1.2 million. The other $5 million was a payoff to Russia for showing up during the Civil War and keeping Britain out of the Civil War. And I said, where on earth did you hear that? I mean, I'm being polite, but I'm stunned. None of my research has shown that. And he said, oh yes, it's in my history book at home. So I said, would you mind scanning me that page and sending it to me on email, and I'm going to take a look at it and I'm going to do some investigating. Well, sure enough, I got home from the market that day and he had scanned and emailed me the page. And it came from Margaret Pilgrim Shaw's book from 1939. And she stated that fact as a fact. So that led me to some archives in Russia, as well as a professor at Loyola University, and all kinds of research. What I discovered was, are you ready for this? Conspiracy theory. Even back in 1865, we had conspiracy theories. And that was what many Americans thought had happened. And so it was rumored around, and it grew and grew and grew. Well, my research showed that before Alaska was purchased and before the Civil War broke out, the Russians and Americans were talking about selling Alaska to the Americans. And they had done an inventory. And their inventory was like $4.8 million. So there's no way they would have settled for $1.2 million. There's no way. You know, so all the research pointed to that being an absolute erroneous theory on the part of conspiracy theorists. So I emailed him all of my information, and I never heard from him again. But it became a chapter in the book. Book two. It's now a chapter in book one revised, because that's where it belongs. But I thought it was so interesting that I ended up putting it in book two. So this one has then the purchase of Alaska. You've got then the Americans heading north. all the adventurers and explorers that went throughout Alaska as much as they could, doing the river system, seeing what was out there, making little lives for themselves as traders and trappers, and gold rushes of the Koyukuk, Juneau Douglas, Cook Inlet, and then the Klondike Gold Rush, as well as the gold rush into Nome in 1899 when they discovered nuggets on the beaches and called that the poor man's gold rush because no one had to stake claims. It was on public property. And so you had 20,000 people rushing from the Klondike who had not found their riches and moved on into Nome. So this one has tons of stories in it about the various people who made all this happen, you know, their lives, what they went through. And then I also wanted to show how difficult it was to get to the gold fields for these guys, because we hear about it all the time. Oh yeah, they climbed the Chilkoot Trail, or I'm down at the Saturday market and I hear someone say, oh, I climbed the Chilkoot Trail. And I think, but did you do it 30 and 40 times with 40 to 50 pounds on your back each time? Because these guys who wanted to go and find their riches had to have a year's worth of supplies, or the Canadians would not let them cross over into Canada. They didn't want to have to pay for these crazy Americans coming north. No way. Well, that equated to about 2,000 pounds per person. So once they got off the steamship in Skagway, if they had known about it, they brought their supplies with. If not, they had to buy them in Skagway where the prices were, or in Daya where the prices were sky high. So now you have 2,000 pounds and you're facing 1,500 ice stairs going up the Chilkoot Trail. So what do you do? Well, you've got to find a spot where nobody else is using to put all the rest of your stuff. You load what you can on your back. You climb up 1,500 ice stairs. You look around for a spot that nobody else is using. Put your stuff down. You find another spot and you come back down on your rear end all the way down to the bottom. Find your stuff again, get another load on your back, maybe wait a couple hours to get in line to go back up those 1,500 ice stairs because there's thousands of guys just like you attempting the same thing. So what do you think after about the 10th or 11th trip? Do you think you might be a bit pooped? So you're starting up that mountain and you stand off to the side. You just can't go anymore. Do you think anybody in that line is going to stop to let you in if they've got the momentum going up that thing? No. It might be another several hours before you can get back into that line to get to the top. Well, glory hallelujah, you now have all your stuff on the top and you're about dead, but you did it. Then you have to drag that 2,000 pounds another 13 miles to either Lake Lindeman or Lake Bennett. And then you have to pitch a tent. And then you have to build a boat. Because they had the Yukon that you had to get your boat onto to go down the Yukon to get to where the actual gold was. Oh my gosh, and kids today complain if they can't find the remote control. Most of the people that actually made it to the gold fields already found all the good claims taken, and what did they do? They sold everything that they had just spent 3 months on average it took them dragging to the gold fields. They sold everything and went back to the lower 48. Those that did actually find gold, very few of them actually kept the gold. The people who made out, any guesses who made the money? Well, he was one of them. Yeah, he lost his life for it too. The merchants, the service providers, the cooks, the restaurateurs, the hotels, the people that were there to serve the miners. They were very good at it. So in the second book, we talk about several of those kind of people. This one goes from 1898 up to 1912. I thought, okay, I'll have two books and then I'll be done with the story. No, no, no. 14 years I got in this one. Too many incredible things happened in this 14-year period of time. Most of Alaska's cities that we know of today happened in this 14-year period of time. Come on in. Fairbanks, Valdez, Cordova, and Seward. The Iditarod Trail was blazed. Ruby and towns along the Iditarod, which, by the way, was actually the Hiditarod. White people changed it to Iditarod because it was so much easier to pronounce. You've got the law and order coming into Alaska, or not. Our first U.S. Deputy Marshal in Eagle turned out to be a wanted murderer from Oklahoma. His story is in here. Wyatt Earp came up in 1901 and built this bar up in Nome. He was very good at mining the miners with alcohol and gambling. He would not spend the winters here, though. Oh, no, no. He had to go back to Hollywood to write his memoirs. He was known as a desperado by Alaska law enforcement. And a letter was found in the basement in Juneau of the courthouse that was very interesting to me. Wyatt did not really want to go to Nome. He had his sights set on Juneau. But the U.S. Deputy Marshal in Juneau heard that Wyatt was coming in on the steamship, and he did not want him in his town. So he got a posse together and met the ship. When Wyatt got off, he said, "Mr. Earp, you are not welcome in my town. I want your gun." He had to hand over his gun. And he said, "You will be on this steamship tomorrow morning when it leaves at 5 a.m. So the story goes that Wyatt spent his time in the Red Dog Saloon. At 5 a.m., he was on the ship, heading out of town without his gun. Now, this cannot be totally corroborated because I've heard two sides to this story, but I heard that his gun was still in the Red Dog Saloon behind the bar on display. I was invited to speak on a Norwegian cruise line in September, going the inside passage, and guess what I did when I got off in Juneau? Come on, honey, we ran to the Red Dog Saloon, where they have a long line and a bouncer, because it is such a tourist attraction that they only let whoever comes out, they let that number of people go in. So it's very regulated how many people can be in the establishment. And I talked to the owner of the Red Dog. He said, "Yes, I've got the gun." I showed him the chapter in my book. He told the bouncer, "Let these two in." And we got to go behind the bar, and there's a gun in a case behind the bar where we got our pictures taken with the owner, the book, and the gun. I will not swear it is Wyatt Earp's gun, but there is a gun in a case behind the bar. So that's kind of cool. This one also shares the stories of the, how the Iditarod Trail was blazed in 1912, 1913, and the first guy, Goodman, who did the trail all the way from Nome down to Seward, it took him months and months and months. And I think of it today, how long was the last Iditarod race with all the new equipment and the fast dogs and the training and whatnot? It wasn't days and days and months and months and months. I mean, it's amazing what has happened in a very short period of time, really, when you think about it. This ends with the eruption in Katmai. And I'm sure you all know about the Katmai National Park, where you have the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. Have any of you felt lava from the 1912 eruption? I don't see any hands. We have lava from the 1912 eruptions. What I want you to do is, put it in your hands, roll it around, pass it to the next person, and when you pass it off, feel that real fine grit on your fingers. And what I want you to imagine is, in June of 1912, when the sunshine normally shines 24 hours a day, the people of Kodiak did not see the sun for three solid days, because that ash was so thick, it blackened their environment. How on earth did they survive? It involved a ship built for about 50 people carrying more than 500 out to sea, the use of a bell of a church to ring to warn the people, and a rope tied from the church down to the docks so the people could feel their way in the darkness. 30 times more ash came out of that than Mount St. Helens. That's where the second one ends. So then I thought, okay, we're going to wrap it up in volume 3. This is going to be good. Then I can move on. I always thought I wanted to be a murder mystery writer. Volume 3, we got a little bit better. It goes from 1912 to 1935. In this one, we have the building of the Alaska Railroad, which birthed Anchorage. Anchorage would not be here today, probably, had it not been for the Alaska Railroad. Well, here's where I'm going to tell you a little personal story. My mother, rest her soul, passed in 87. My mother and her identical twin sister, Hope, were two of the first twins born in the Anchorage Railroad Hospital in 1921. Story goes, miners came from hundreds of miles around just to see these two little identical twins who grew up in Hope and in Seward. My mother, for years, would always talk down about Anchorage. She hated Anchorage. And when I pressed her, it was because Anchorage stole the big city away from Seward. Well, in my research, it's true. Initially, the federal government wanted Seward or foresaw that Seward was going to be the big metropolis of Alaska. But in my investigation, as I was putting this book together, what did I find? The people of Seward, once they learned that the federal government was going to make them the big city in Alaska, started raising the prices of their land. To the point the federal government said, there's a really good Anchorage a few miles up that way on a place called Ship Creek. We can just haul our stuff up there, and that's where we'll put it if you're going to be that way. Well, my mother had passed away by the time I learned this. I think she's around me sometimes, looking down on me going, Laurel Ann. But, dear mother, if you'd been alive, you would have been the first person I told when I found that out. It was Seward's own fault, really. So Anchorage starts coming up from nothing. The first spike was hit April 10th in 1915 by a woman by the name of Miss White, down in the Ship Creek area that actually started the construction of the Alaska Railroad. I thought it was neat that a woman, because you're always hearing about the men who built the railroad and the men are doing this, that, and the other thing. So woman power. And then I started to really research on people of the time. Who was here? Who were the movers and shakers? So there's a very nice story in here that my aunt had written on Z.J. Lusack. He was Alaska's first real philanthropist. He came to Alaska three different times, left broke every time. He was in search of gold. But he actually came the last time, settled in Anchorage, and started his little drugstore, a pharmacy. And he befriended the people that lived here. He would let them come in for free and write letters that would be mailed home then to their families. And he amassed quite a fortune and became Anchorage's first philanthropist. And then there was Russian Jack. Who was Russian Jack? We have things named for Russian Jack. He was a murderer. He was at a party, got in an argument with a fella, and killed him, and did time. And as soon as he came out of prison, Anchorage people nominated him the Mardi Gras King. They loved him, which now we have things named for him. Isn't that fascinating to know that little tidbit of Anchorage history? Our oldest unsolved murder, our very first police chief, 1921 February, we had just incorporated November 23rd, 1920, into a city, a town, and the city council, we need to crack down on gambling and liquor, bootlegging. And so the mandate was then to hire a police chief and get right down to it and clean this city up. There were ordinances called the Curtain Ordinance, where you had to have an open view into any bar, establishment, pool hall, because they wanted to be able to walk up and down the street and make sure you weren't doing anything in there that was illegal. There was an 8-mile-an-hour speed limit down 4th Avenue. And our police chief got a call out one evening, and he was shot dead in the alley that is next to the Anchorage Hotel. And they never did discover who did it. And I have a nice chapter in here on that. I got help with that with John Bagoy, wonderful, wonderful man. He helped me with that story and gave me some awesome pictures and insight to that. And I think one of the things that we might conclude, because there's absolutely no proof and nobody will ever know, but my personal opinion is it was probably one of the city council people, because I think many of them were bootleggers and gamblers, and they did not want the city to be cleaned up because they were making too much money. So it kind of stands to reason to me anyway.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Alaska historian Laurel Downing Bill. Bill's own Alaskan family is what got her hooked on history. And since then, she's written 4 history books. There's a 5th one on the way. At the Lusac Library last week, Bill tells an audience about the research and history that goes into each of her books in the Aunt Phil's Trunk series.
This also then has the stories of the early aviation in Alaska. Through my research, I learned the very first thing that went up in Alaska's skies, which probably won't make any difference to anybody, but I thought it was cool. It was a hot air balloon, 1899 in Juneau. The first plane that was built in Alaska was in Kotzebue. It was built in a warehouse. It was wheeled out. It never did get off the ground, and it was wheeled back into the warehouse. So news you can use, folks. I don't know when you're going to be able to use that, but it's in here. As well as the colony, how the colony was set up from the Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal was to get an agricultural community set up, and so they brought these 202 families from the Midwest and dropped them in the wilderness and said, create an agricultural community. Can you imagine? My gosh, how hard that would be. Well, while I was doing research on that story, I came across this little tidbit. The federal government issued these poor people, I say that, because they were bingles that they could use, not money, so they had to shop in the company store, which kind of curtailed their spending ability, and they issued the men of the colony an official farming outfit. Page 275. Are you ready? Ta-da! Have you ever in your life seen a farmer dressed anything even closely resembling this photograph? My personal opinion is that the federal government had an excess of World War I gear that they were trying to unload, and the farmers were the recipients. The last chapter in number three is the crash, the fatal crash in 1935, August, in Barrow, near Barrow, of Wiley Post and Will Rogers. Will Rogers was a much-loved humorist. Wiley Post was an aviator. They were best buddies. They were doing it around the world. They should not have taken off when they did. They'd left the Matanuska Valley colony, and they were heading off on their adventure, got into fog, crashed and died near Barrow. The last word written on Wiley Post, who did a column, by the way, a national column, the last word on his typewriter was death. Now, no one can say that he had any premonitions. It was coincidence, I'm sure, that that was the last word that he had written that was in his typewriter. But it's kind of weird.
Where was his typewriter?
They found it in the wreckage.
Oh, in the plane?
Yeah, in the wreckage. And a very cool thing that I didn't know, there's a really nice stone monument in Barrow dedicated to Will Rogers, and it's made from the same stone quarry as the monument to him in Claremore, Oklahoma. So that's kind of a cool tie that Oklahoma and Barrow are kind of tied together with monuments made from the same stone quarry. I think it's kind of cool anyway. It doesn't take much to amuse me, but. And then the fourth one, I said, all right, this is it. Whew. Four books, we're going to be done. 1935 to 1960. There was way too much stuff going on. World War II, Cold War, statehood struggle, Alaska Natives' struggle for civil rights. I could not do it justice if I just whipped through it really fast. So I found some amazing stories that help tell the story of what Alaska was going through during this period of time. How many of you, let me see if I can find that photo first, does the name Jimmy Doolittle ring a bell? Page 120. Jimmy Doolittle, a World War II hero. Doolittle Raiders, they took off from an aircraft carrier and they bombed Tokyo. Huge deal back in the early 1940s. I learned Jimmy grew up in Nome. And the boys in Nome beat him up all the time because he had these beautiful curls. And he was short. So he came home one day all bloodied up. And his father looked at him and said, son, you have three things. You have this, he points to his head. You got these, and he balls up his fists. His father had bound together some pillows, and he taught Jimmy how to defend himself, how to fight, how to hit those pillows and defend himself. So the next time he went to school and the boys came up to start beating up on him, he just pummeled them. And he said later in life that that experience of growing up in Nome helped him have the courage and the inner strength that he needed to go across the sea and bomb Tokyo. Now, Jimmy, without knowing it, kind of led to the Japanese invading the Aleutian chain. Because the Japanese, who never thought anybody could ever bomb them, they thought that their homeland was secure, their emperor was God, nobody could touch them. And Jimmy proved that was not true. The Japanese thought he had taken off from a grand Air Force base in the Aleutian chain. So they sent airplanes over and they bombed. They wanted to destroy this big Air Force base. Well, we didn't have an Air Force base. Jimmy had taken off from an aircraft carrier. So the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor 2 days in a row. Then they went and bombed Attu. They occupied Attu. They killed the husband of the school teacher, Etta Jones' husband. They assassinated him. And they took Etta and the people of the village of Attu to concentration camps in Japan, where probably close to half, if not more, of them died. Then they occupied Kiska, and it was almost a year later, 11 months, where the American Army first amphibious landing came across and landed on Attu to fight the Japanese. They thought that they would get them out of there within a matter of days, but had not listened to any of the experts or told them what kind of climate they could face, what kind of gear they should be wearing, what kind of provisions they should have. The military ignored all of that. And so our troops got bogged down, they got trench foot, they were not well equipped whatsoever for the weather of the Aleutians. And it took them more than 3 weeks to get the Japanese out at a cost only second to Iwo Jima. But nobody knew about it because the military did not want America to know the Japanese had occupied American soil. They thought the rest of the lower 48, as we call them, would panic if they knew the Japanese were on our land. And they're probably right. I bet a lot of people would have panicked had they known that. We had a secret mission with the Russians as well during this time. It was called the Lend-Lease. But I like to think of it as a group of women, again, who ferried airplanes from Montana up to Fairbanks, turned them over to Soviet pilots who took them to the front to fight the Nazis. And nobody knew about that either. That was another hush-hush. One day the Americans woke up, the people in Fairbanks woke up, and they'd go to their store, and all the stockings were purchased, and all the stuff from the shelves were taken, because these Soviet pilots were buying everything in sight to take home to their families and girlfriends. And they were hearing Russian spoken all the stores. They had no clue what was happening. But it was because they were taking the airplanes back over to Russia to fight the Nazis. Another very cool story in here. You know, I get people all the time. I say, oh, have you heard of my series? Are you interested in Alaska history? And you know what I hear a lot? I hear, oh, I've lived here forever. And I always smile, and that's great. I'm a third generation. What I really want to say is, really? Do you know everything there is to know about Alaska just because you walk our streets and have for 30 years? And then I'll do this story. 1939, the U.S. Army Air Corps wanted a theme song. So they had a nationwide contest. Even Irving Berlin submitted music and lyrics. The committee didn't like anything that came in. And at the last minute, they received, "Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder," written by the flying baritone of Fairbanks, Alaska. Robert Crawford wrote the Air Force song. Music and lyrics went to the moon on the Apollo 15, and I located all of the original words, which just the other day I was showing to an Air Force retiree, and he was speechless. That was on page 115. He was speechless. He said, well, we were taught the first verse, and I kind of know the last verse, but I had no clue the other two verses were in there. Other stories in this one include the Alaska Native struggle for civil rights. My mother used to tell me, well, she didn't used to tell me, let me rephrase that. I was brought up third generation not to be discriminate against anybody. Everybody was equal. That's how we were raised. But my mother, before she passed away, and I can't remember even the conversation we had, she told me, growing up in Seward, she could remember seeing signs that said, no dogs, no natives allowed. That made my heart hurt. So I wanted to make sure, and I did that throughout every one of my books. I tried to find out what was going on in the Native population at the same time things were going on with the Caucasian population, Black population, whatever people were in Alaska. I was trying to cover everything because this is a look at Alaska. It's not just a fine mirror that I'm looking at myself in. So I researched and I did a nice chapter on the struggles and how in 1940s, Alaska passed legislation, the anti-discrimination, way before the lower 48 even addressed it. So I think that's pretty cool for Alaskans to take a stand and our Alaska Native people to make sure that their voices were heard and are still heard to this day. And then this one goes on up to the struggle for statehood, what it took to become a state. So that's where this one ends. The fifth book, I am working on it right now. I am hoping, now you remember, I was going to have a book, but I'm hoping to have the first 50 years of statehood that will take us from 1959 up to 2009. But again, I am coming across some stories that are absolutely unbelievable, absolutely incredible, and so it may only be the first 25 years of statehood. We'll see what happens with that. The reason number five, now number one came out May 2006, number two, May 2007. Number three, May 2008. Number four, May 2009. Boom, 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 boom. And here we are, May 2014 has come and gone, and I still don't have number five. A few things have happened. One of them, my handsome husband went through triple heart bypass, aortic valve replacement. So we had some time that we were taking care of him. But I think you can probably get a feeling that I don't let too much grass grow under my feet, regardless of what's going on. So I thought, my husband, he should not be denied goodies because he was borderline diabetic and going through heart problems. That takes me to the other side of my three generations in Alaska, my great-grandfather on my mother's side. Robert Burns Matheson was one of the first settlers of hope. He arrived in the 1896-1897. He took 389 ounces of gold out of Resurrection Creek in 59 days. That's what those three sacks represent. In today's dollars, it's about $250,000. The two nuggets on my engagement ring are buried in those sacks somewhere. So, he lost his fortune because he built a sawmill and a general store. He built the little schoolhouse they still use for a library, because he believed that Hope was going to be the metropolis of Alaska. Well, what happened in 1898? The Klondike Gold Rush. Everyone left Hope and Sunrise for the Klondike. That left my great-grandfather with no customers. So he lost his fortune. But he kept his sourdough going. I've learned to dry it. And so, while not working on volume five, while my husband was recuperating, I was working on recipes that were lower in fat, lower in sodium, lower in sugar, so he could still have treats and not be, you know, health-wise, anything bad for him. So we created treats like cranberry chocolate cake, white chocolate cherry muffins, pancakes, waffles, pizza dough, even dog biscuits, with peanut butter and bacon grease that the dogs love, all out of sourdough. So all you need to do is add 1 cup of water, 1 cup of flour a day for 3 days. You have a 118-year-old sourdough starter that is absolutely fabulous. So it fits into my slogan, which is bringing Alaska's history alive. How much more alive can you get than a 118-year-old sourdough starter? So then I was getting ready to work on number five because he was healthy, things were going great. We were down in South Texas and a lady emails me and says, "My name's Lisa Augustine. We were one of the first white families on the Kenai Peninsula. I just bought your Aunt Phil's trunk book. You've misidentified your grandfather." What? Well, I've got this picture of my grandfather in the very beginning, and I thought he was the short one because I had never met him, and the Seward Library had identified him, and so I put it in my book as fact. Lisa knew my grandfather because her parents had been in Alaska in the 1930s. They had no money, winter was coming, and they had no prospects. They ran into my grandfather, who said, "Tell you what, if the wife will cook for me and my brother Charlie, you can work with me on the trap line this winter and my gold mine this summer." Done deal. They moved in with my grandfather and his uncle Charlie in their cabin in Hope for 2 years. They lived with my grandfather. During that time, Lisa came along. So Lisa grew up around my grandfather. She said, "Laurel, my mother wrote a journal about those 2 years. Would you like to read it?" Yes. She mailed it to me. I read it. I made copies. I was so excited. I went to send it back to her. Her return address is Lincoln, California. Our son moved to Lincoln, California the year before to work as a golfer at a golf club. We were driving to Lincoln in May, and I thought, wow, I want to meet this gal. So it turns out she lives half a mile away from where my son works. We called her up, we met, we talked. It's like a cousin, a sister. You know, you get that immediate bond. It was amazing. She has horrible health. She has COPD, like 20% lung capacity. And she says to me during this little two-hour conversation, "Well, you know, I wrote my memoirs years ago," and she did. It was called The Dragline Kid. That's her book. She wrote it in 2002. Super well-received, very nice book about growing up as one of the first white families on the Kenai Peninsula. And she said, "Now, I've created this little fictional story. It's a historical fiction, and I'll probably never see it published." Well, my mind says I've been led to this woman for a reason. So I said, "Why don't you let me see your manuscript? If it's something I think I can work with, I'll try and publish it for you." I'd never done anything like this before, but I, you know, things don't happen by coincidence in my world. So I brought her manuscript home. I absolutely loved it. She creates this little place, Muckluck, halfway between Hope and Moose Pass, where the men were mucking with no luck back in the 1930s and 40s. It is hysterical. It rings true of the characters of the time from the viewpoint of a 95-year-old woman. I edited, I published it. It came out just before the fair last year. So throughout the book, people are solving problems over coffee. Any longtime Alaskan knows you always had your coffee pot on. That was just what you did. You never knew who was going to drop by. It was indoctrinated to me as a kid. When you grow up, you have your coffee pot. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun to hand out little cups of coffee? One cup for every time they bought a book, they got a free cup of coffee. My husband and I went to Costco, and we bought a box of single-serve little coffees, San Francisco Bay Company. Out to the fair we go. We had a ball. Every time somebody bought a cup of coffee, I handed them a free cup of coffee. I handed them a free cup of coffee. Fourth, fifth day there, my husband brings me supper, and he's sitting there, and he's looking at that box of coffee, and he says, "Do you know where that coffee was made?" Lincoln, California. So my guilt over not working on number 5 totally went away, because that was my sign that I had done what I needed to do, and that was get Lisa's book done. Now, what are your questions? Anybody have questions for me? Yes.
A member of the audience tells Bill that he's really interested in Native ways of knowing and education, and he asks Bill if those ways were marginalized at all when Caucasian people arrived to Alaska.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of forced education. In the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s, a lot of religious groups divided Alaska up. And the Baptists got this section, and the Episcopalians got this section, and the Moravians got this section. And before that, you had the Russian Orthodox that came over from Russia, and they started trying to civilize the Native people. And so the Native people were used to their oral traditions, being taught by their elders and their parents, the ways of survival, and being a good person and sharing, all these things that came into the Native's way. The white people saw this as just heathenistic. And yes, they tried to get them to stop speaking their language. They would be punished if they were speaking their language, if they were in like a mission school. I think there's a whole generation that we're seeing a lot of things that are happening now from people that were forced to leave their villages and go to boarding schools. So you have a whole generation that doesn't know how to raise children because the children were taken away. And so they were raised in a boarding school, so they didn't have anyone to look at for guidance on how to raise kids, and so they're trying to raise kids now. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that. That's way deep. There's tons of things that happened that are not right. And I think what we're seeing today are Native people trying to go back to their culture, to embrace their culture, yet also be a part of the Western culture, because they cannot totally go back anymore. It's just impossible. But I think we're seeing a lot of people like they're trying to revive their languages, and they're teaching the elders trying to teach the younger people their ways. But then on the other side of the coin, you have so many villages now that are struggling because the economics in the villages are so bad, the kids are all moving into the westernized cities. So, yeah. Yes.
A member of the audience comments that the federal government played a role in establishing Western schools in Alaska.
Yes. The federal government absolutely is to blame for many, many of the injustices to the Native people. When they gave them the right to vote back in the early 1900s, it was if they wore Western clothes, spoke English, and had five white people verify and stand up for them. Yeah. There was just a lot of stuff that was done to them. Other questions? Yes.
Someone asks Bill if she has plans to include the story of Alaska serial killer Robert Hansen in her fifth book.
The murderer? Well, I do have a lot of notes on him. I'm struggling with that. Murder sells books. You know, it's in my second book, the blue one, from 1898 to 1912. A man murdered a man over a woman in Juneau, and I did put that one in there because it was really interesting to me. He was incarcerated, McNeil Island, Washington, sent to prison soon thereafter to Leavenworth because he was a very ornery prisoner. He was in Leavenworth for many, many, many years. He was just about to be released when he stabbed a guard to death, and that earned him a spot on Alcatraz. Most of America knows him as the Birdman. I thought that was interesting, and so I did put that in there. But a psychopath who hunts helpless females, I don't know that I want it in Aunt Phil's trunk. I have the records. I have it.
Is this the story of Ben did making the movie?
Yeah, the Butcher Baker. I have the information. I just don't know. You know, why give him any kind of glory? If I was to do it, I might try to do chapters on the women. But again, I don't see that. It might be in mentions, you know. Yes, we had these horrible people. I might do something in mention, but I don't really want to dedicate a chapter. I have other things like the Homer, little Homer. And okay, pinky swear, everybody in here, you cannot tell this story to anybody, all right? I pinky swear, I'm going to find you. If I hear this story told outside, anywhere, you guys, I'm coming for you. I want you to sign my guest book.
At this point in the talk, Bill actually goes around and pinky swears with everyone in the room to keep her next story secret. I'm sworn by the power of the pinky, but I will tell you that the story involves one Alaska town's new heights of ingenuity to procure itself a new fire engine. Here's Bill again.
How cool is that story? I would rather tell that story than tell of Hansen being a butcher and killing these women. You know, I guess... Anyway, that's my, it may make it in there, but at this point, that's kind of where I'm leaving. There's too many other really, really cool stories of people doing awesome things that I can talk about bad things in one chapter, and I can be done with it. Other questions?
Someone asks if Bill has done much research on the Klondike women, like Fannie Quigley.
I don't have Fannie Quigley. She's got her own book, you know. There's a lot of, I might, because she passed away, I think it was after 1960, right? In the 40s. Then, yeah, I may be able to bring her in if I'm talking about the Kentishna or the park or something. I can bring her in something about her. But I do have the two Klondike Kates. Mm-hmm. We have Klondike Kate Rockwell, who was the flame of the Yukon, who danced her way across the stages, and men pelted her with gold nuggets. I've often thought I could have done that. But
it probably hurts.
I wouldn't care if they were gold nuggets. I would have done it. But there was another Kate, and her name was Kate Ryan from Canada, who was a very good Christian girl, who nursed many of the sick miners to health, and she was just an awesome, sweet girl. And the miners nicknamed her Klondike Kate. And then the word got back to her parents that their daughter was known as Klondike Kate, and they'd heard about the Klondike Kate. So there was some trouble brewing there for a while. So I've got that story in there. One of the things I always try to do is find the stories that you are not going to find anywhere else, or tell them in a different way and find other angles for it to enlighten and entertain and engage and educate. My best compliment came Joe Antonsen, who is now the state historian. She was my professor 12 years ago when I had to take Alaska history to get my degree. And she came up to me at a book signing, I believe it was at the Fine Arts Museum last year, and whispered in my ear, "I'm using your books for research now." That is awesome. You know, that's validation that I've done something to perpetuate my aunt's body of work. Her life meant something. She's in the Library of Congress now, and people are loving Aunt Phil's trunk. Well, thank you very much. I mean, it was a small group, but I think we had some fun. I hope you all learned a little something, and you're going to take away with a smile on your face. Alaska history can be a lot of fun. It doesn't have to be boring and stodgy like a textbook. And textbooks don't have to be boring and stodgy either. So thank you again. Thank you for asking me.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Alaska historian Laurel Downing Bill. She's the author of the Aunt Phil's Trunk History Series, and Bill credits her own Alaskan family, all three generations of them, with igniting her interest in history. Bill spoke at the Lusac Library last week, September 11th. For more information on Laurel Downing Bill and Aunt Phil's Trunk History Series, you can visit her website at auntphilstrunk.com. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.